Chapter 7 Leaderless. A statesman, Bismarck, if I'm not mistaken, once said that to accept a thing in principle means, in the language of diplomacy, to reject it in effect. V.I. Lenin. There was a lot of quick, decisive action in the spring of 1917. From Berlin and Vienna to Paris, London and Washington, assistant secretaries laboured through a haze of perspiration. In Petrograd, after all, 300 years of Romanov autocracy had just been swept away in a single dizzying week. But some things were too solemn to be hurried, and one important ceremony stood out. On the 23rd of March, or the 5th of April 1917, the citizens of Petrograd gathered together to bury their dead. However they had met their end, shot by police, caught in crossfire, or killed in one of the countless accidents with guns, the heroes of the revolution were now martyrs in a holy cause. Officially, there were 1,382 of them, 869 of whom were soldiers. Their deaths had meaning far beyond the everyday. Nothing that a politician could promise, and certainly no written words, meant more to the people of Petrograd than the grief and awe that they felt in the face of irrecoverable sacrifice. It was because the funeral was so portentous that it had taken almost a month to organise. The plan at first had been to dig up Palace Square. There would have been poetry in that, for it had been the scene of the Bloody Sunday Massacre of 1905. Some enthusiastic amateur digging was actually begun there, Frank Linley wrote in a report to London, but the hardness of the frozen ground and the number of water, gas and electric light mains encountered by the excavators caused a change of plan. Another theory was that Maxim Gorky intervened. The writer's passion for artistic heritage was even better known than his disdain for loutish elements within the working class. Meanwhile, reported Lidley, Lvov and his liberal ministers hoped that the whole idea might end up being dropped, fearing fresh mayhem in a city that no longer had police. The wrangling and delay went on so long that many people went ahead and buried their loved ones themselves. The eventual site was an open space, known locally as the Petersburg Sahara, close to the Pavlovsky Barracks. A century before, it had been a parade ground for the Imperial military, and the name that it had acquired then, Mars Field, had stuck. More recently, there had been plans to build a permanent home for the Duma there, but nothing had been done before the war broke out. It was an empty plot, in other words, one of the last in central Petrograd, and it suited the purpose perfectly. It also happened that the British Embassy backed onto it, affording staff the opportunity for a grandstand view. Petrograd citizens were their own master of ceremonies. The Soviet did some of the work of coordination, using its newspaper Izvestia to publicise the order and timing of the procession. But it was the people who painted the banners, comforted the bereaved, and set off with determined step toward the field of graves. Every factory and district had its place. Each coffin, its red flag. The bodies of those who had already been interred elsewhere were represented in the ceremony by wooden planks, each carried with as much respect as any sacred dead. There was no impatience as the procession flowed along the boulevards. The customary hum of the city stopped, and the sky, for once, was clear of smoke. 900,000 people marched, their steps beating a rhythm, muffled by their heavy coats. They sang the hymns of revolution, solemn but secular, and though there was no conductor, they kept more or less in time. As each coffin was laid in the ground, the guns of the Peter Paul fortress sounded from across the water, booming like apocalyptic drums. 6 naval searchlights illuminated the ceremony as it continued long into the night. As Harold Williams put it, no Tsar was ever given a burial like this. It was a magnificent and moving triumphal procession of the revolution, and of the masses who had made it, wrote Sukharnov. Trotsky agreed. Everybody went to the funeral, he wrote, along with workers, soldiers, and the small city people. Here were students, ministers, ambassadors, the solid bourgeois, journalists, orators, leaders of all the parties. In his report for London, written with teeth tightly clenched, Sir John Hanbury Williams attempted a similar generosity. The event, he conceded, which had been anticipated with lively dread by many, turned out to be a real triumph for the Russian democracy and a great encouragement to all its friends. In private, however, the endless repetition of the Marseillaise, the Russians sang their own version, which they knew as the Marseillaise, had irritated him beyond endurance. It was so monotonous, he wrote in his diary, that the victims of the revolution themselves were likely to rise from their graves and ask them to stop if they keep at it all the time. Pleasant from our embassy, which adjoins. These Russian mourners, to an English eye, lacked even basic refinement. In the opinion of Buchanan's daughter Meriel, who was never a friend of revolutionaries, the rain-sodden crowd amounted to a seething mass of women, children, workmen and soldiers, all carrying crimson banners at different angles, all singing the Marseillaise at a different time and in a different key. It was the people's raw emotion that had made some onlookers nervous. They felt its power. The sound of tramping feet beat out a requiem for the old world. But no one could be sure where it might lead. There were divisions everywhere. The absence of any religious ceremony was a feature of the funeral, due to the definitely anti-religious sentiments of the Social Democrats, Lindley observed, and gave rise to a good deal of criticism among the general public. Palaiologue dismissed the evidence of revolutionary consciousness, of newborn, raw, dignified citizenship, by remarking that the art of mise-en-scène is native to the Russians. Even Tseretelli turned out to have misgivings. Though he sympathised deeply with the people's grief, he regarded the funeral as the last act in the revolution's youthful phase, spontaneous, emotional, but necessarily to be replaced by leadership of the professional kind. There was everywhere a passion for speech, remembered Knox. A new verb was coined, mitingovat, to attend meetings. A man would ask his friend what he was going to do that evening, and the reply would be, I will attend meetings a little. Ya nemnogo mitingayu. Everyone wanted to thrash things out. All sensed a new responsibility, a pride in their own sovereign state. Doormen, street sweepers and court staff, who are called lackeys in Russian, demanded new job titles to reflect their status as free human beings. Respect for their dignity had been one of the first conditions that the Petrograd garrison wrote in Order No. 1. New names, from comrade rifleman to street sanitation superintendent, were relatively easily achieved. What was more difficult at a time of national danger and economic collapse was to find the new republic's way ahead. Perhaps it was because the problems were so hard that people talked incessantly of theory or of trivialities. Apart from peace and bread, the one thing that the people yearned for most was something new, an end to the old ways, the lies, the government by strangers in expensive suits. The February days had inspired a sense of possibility, and everyone, from the oil-spattered machinists of Viborg to the peasants on the rich black earth, tasted a moment of empowerment. They were not wrong. Their world had changed forever. In Petrograd, however, it was another set of businessmen and intellectuals, well-meaning but abstracted from the people's real lives, who quickly took to running things. For just over 8 months in 1917, the men who managed the greatest revolution that the world had ever seen rehearsed the manners and vocabulary of genteel government. They debated treaty terms in diplomatic French, and brokered deals behind closed doors, They traded concessions and massaged words. They could do nothing else, in fact, because the one thing that kept them awake at night was the spectre of social unrest, even of anarchy. One group of them, survivors of the left-wing anti-Tsarist underground, met daily in the apartment of Matvey Skobelev, which was where Tsaratelli had been staying since his return to the capital. Only a handful of ex-com members was invited. Sukhanov, whom Tsaratelli thought dry, cold and bilious, was not part of the group, and there were certainly no Bolsheviks. Small though it was, this largely Menshevik caucus, which was soon nicknamed the Star Chamber, had taken control of the ex-com's work by the end of March. It set the agenda, that is, and it coined a string of catchy terms. But what it refused to do, as the fires of revolution cooled, was to allow the bourgeois government to step aside. Hamstrung by fear of the wrong sort of change, its members were dependent on the goodwill of the likes of Prince Lvov. The most immediate problems, unsurprisingly, were the same as they had been before the February days, though now there was no Tsar available to take the blame. The war, or maybe the question of peace, remained the most controversial. It was majestic, and it made a lot of noise. But the Soviets' manifesto to the peoples of the world had settled nothing. Though Tsaratelli's group now had firm views, the rest of the ex-com remained divided, and arguments between the many factions, about armed defence and fraternisation, about war production and the details of the coming spring's campaigns, foiled all attempts at unity. Meanwhile, as the Soviet wrestled with its conscience, the provisional government, in its new Marinsky Palace home, debated the same issues, albeit from a subtly different point of view. With their empire poised to collapse, the issue that the ministers chose to fight over was land grab. On the 23rd of March, or the 5th of April, the very day of Petrograd's great funeral, the pro-government newspaper Rech carried an interview with Milyukov that had been timed to coincide with US President Woodrow Wilson's declaration of war. The foreign minister took the opportunity to restate his determination to honour Russia's existing treaties. What he meant, although he did not quite venture the phrase, was that Russia would need to help itself to several portions of foreign-held territory if it were to fulfil its duties as a genuine world power. Milyukov proposed a union of the Ukrainian population of the Austrian regions with the populations of our own Ukrainian regions, a cloak for Russian expansion into Galicia. The real prize, however, remained that swathe of Turkey. Milyukov justified the annexation of Constantinople on the grounds that the Turkish nation, in spite of 500 years' domination, has not spread its roots deeply there. As the Turks would have been shocked to learn, he regarded a move on the Straits as simple housekeeping, a measure to protect the doors to Russia's home. The foreign minister never doubted that he was right where Turkey was concerned, and he made no attempt to conceal his impatience with the Soviet. Peace without annexations, he concluded, amounted to a German formula that they endeavour to pass off as an international socialist one. As Buchanan observed, Milyukov had absolutely refused, so long as he remained Minister for Foreign Affairs, to negotiate with allies for a modification of agreements already concluded. In Tsaratelli's view, it was like throwing down the gauntlet to the whole revolutionary democracy. But the ex-com was trapped, for Milyukov, at the ex-com's own request, had full responsibility for foreign affairs. It was Kerensky, who could never glimpse fresh moral heights without leaping to claim them, who next began to stir up trouble. Buchanan drafted a late-evening report about the furore on the 8th of April, the day that he and other Anglicans had celebrated Easter. With eggs and children's stories on his mind, he may unconsciously have thought of Tweedledum and Tweedledee as he began to write. One of Labour papers published today a statement by Minister of Justice, Kerensky, to the effect that Minister for Foreign Affairs, Milyukov, in interview, had spoken in his own name and not in that of government, he began. As Minister of Justice called on me this evening, I asked him why he had published this statement. He replied he had done so because Minister for Foreign Affairs had spoken without consulting his colleagues and that he moreover considered it very tactless on the part of Minister for Foreign Affairs to make a declaration which had placed government in a very difficult situation. It was not the detail of the argument alone that was so damaging, clearly, but also the puerile carping. While that continued, there was little chance that the provisional government could build a base of public trust or even hold coherent negotiations with its military allies. There was also likely to be opposition from the leftists and the Soviet. As a despairing Buchanan observed the next morning, "The provisional government will not be master until it has put committee, which is self-constituted body representing a small minority of extremists, in its proper place." With much the same concerns in mind, Tseretelli had been working on the Soviet ex-com. He remained an internationalist, he said, but he wanted the Soviet to work beside the bourgeoisie, to cooperate, if not ally with it, and help create a common foreign policy and win the war. Tseretelli's reputation for statesmanship had continued to grow since his return, and on the 22nd of March, or the 4th of April, the ex-com agreed to approach Lvov's government for a clear statement of its war aims, intending to use that as the basis for a united campaign of national defence. Sukarnov was sceptical. He had been pressing for a nationwide, systematic campaign for peace, and his goal was to expose and then trap the bourgeois ministers, not to work with them. Deals fixed behind the locked doors of a palace, after all, were precisely the sort of thing that the People's Revolution had been made to thwart. His doubts still simmering, his powder dry, Sukarnov nonetheless joined Tseretelli on the ex-com's negotiating team. The black cars swept them off to the Marinsky Palace on the 24th of March, or the 6th of April. Their host and chairman was Prince Lvov, and every member of his cabinet was present except Kerensky. Tseretelli tried to be convincing to the ministers, Sukarnov wrote, looking for points of departure that were close to them. Still, neither side was keen to compromise, and a boring, long-winded, futile discussion started. The knives were out among the ministers as well. There were rumours of a Masonic conspiracy involving Kerensky and the millionaire Minister of Finance, Mikhail Tereshchenko. Much later, Milyukov claimed to have identified a plot against him by an unlikely gang whose members included Tseretelli, Prince Lvov, Kerensky, and Sir George Buchanan. After a taut but gentlemanly exchange of views, the ex-com members took their leave, giving the ministers a day to formulate a statement of war aims. On the 26th of March, or the 8th of April, Lvov called the Soviet executive representatives back to the palace to hear the statement that had been prepared. Its wording was a disappointment, pompous, vague, and patronizing. "The defense of our own inheritance at any price, and the liberation of our country from the invading enemy," it began, "constitute the foremost task of our fighters defending the nation's liberty." The declaration insisted that Free Russia did not aim to dominate other nations or seize their national possessions. But the ministers had opted not to use the Soviets' phrase "peace without annexation or indemnities." Instead, they sought a stable peace based on national self-determination, while promising, Milyukov must have fought for hours, that "the obligations undertaken towards our allies will be fully observed." Expansion was a war aim that the Soviet would not condone. The ex-com group resigned itself to a long night of talks. At one point, Tereshchenko bounded from his seat, accusing Sukarnov of comparing the current ministers to the disgraced ex-Tsar. He flounced out of the building for a while, only to slink back sometime after dark, when his outrage had cooled. Later still, and well after midnight, the telephone rang for Chidza. It was his wife, and she was calling in despair. Their son, who was 15 or 16 at the time, had injured himself in an accident with a loaded gun and was not expected to live for more than an hour. Chidza opted to stay at the meeting. By the time he got home, his son was dead. The talks collapsed in any case. Lvov seemed to be backing Milyukov. He knew that the ex-com was trapped. The leaders of the Soviet were on the verge of giving up. The next morning, however, it was Tseretelli's turn to hurry to the telephone. The voice that squawked into his ear was Prince Lvov's. A packet containing a revised document, the prince explained, was on its way to the Taurid. The ex-com group, gathering round when it arrived, discovered that 6 words, underlined in red pencil, had been inserted into the previous day's text. The important new phrase renounced any violent seizure of foreign territory. Tseretelli was triumphant. He had secured his declaration and a new alliance with the bourgeois government. He also knew that he had outmaneuvered the large group of left-wingers in the Soviet who wanted an immediate peace. Exactly what the wording meant for real soldiers fighting at real frontiers was something they could all leave for another day. The compromise did nothing to enhance the reputations of its signatories. Tseretelli and his friends had done their best, and as Marxists, they regarded revolution as the heart of their entire lives. But the ex-com team had now appeared for what it was, a group of politicians with a questionable mandate and a poor to hopeless grasp of real life. The history of the committee, remembered one of the participants, can be divided into 2 periods, before and after Tseretelli's arrival. He led the committee calmly, full of confidence and courage, until suddenly the random hodgepodge of people was transformed into an institution. Yet strangely enough, at the precise moment when the committee became organized, it allowed the leadership of the masses, who turned their backs on the committee, to slip out of its hands. On the 27th of March, or the 9th of April, the very day when Lenin's train pulled out of Zurich station on its way to Germany, the Provisional Government's declaration on the war, complete with an endorsement in the name of the Soviet, was published in Russia. Attentive readers knew at once that the revolution's promised peace, the peace of people's dearest dreams, had been deferred indefinitely. "My dear Knox, you must be easy," a cheerful Rodchenko commented to the British officer the following day. "Russia is a big country, and can wage a war and manage a revolution at the same time." When Buchanan asked Prince Lvov for an explanation of the Soviets' cherished peace without annexations, the nobleman was equally complacent. "If the war went well for us," he suggested, "those who now spoke of the permanent occupation of Constantinople and Galicia as annexation would regard it as liberation from the enemy yoke." It was the sort of comment Lenin had in mind when he observed that to urge the provisional government to conclude a democratic peace is like preaching virtue to brothel keepers. The soldiers were the obstacle that no one wanted to discuss. Whatever Prince Lvov might say, Russia's foreign plans depended on the army, and no one knew exactly what was in its members' minds. Local troops made a poor litmus test, though most people had nothing else from which to judge. "Petrograd garrison has issued a declaration drawn up by both officers and men, emphasizing the necessity of continuing war until new won freedom is secured," Buchanan informed London in a telegram of the 28th of March or 10th of April. "A declaration states that war must be fought to successful end because army considers that peace, even restoring Russia's former frontiers, would, if reached without agreement, allies be shameful. Resolution calls on committee to end all quarrels between workmen and technical staff of Petrograd works factories, as these quarrels causing incalculable harm. Army. Finally, to increase munitions output, 8 hours a day is to be suspended and work continued unceasingly at highest pressure, bearing in mind that army is working night and day." In all, the news was looking good. But anyone who toured the front would have been troubled by the conscripts' fragile mood. The provisional government had been the first to send inspectors out. In March, two former Duma members called Yanushkevich and Filonenko were dispatched to tour the northern front. Their report was almost entirely positive. "Morale is so gay, joyful and good that it makes you happy." Elsewhere, other inspectors watched as soldiers lined up on parade to show how good things were supposed to be. Though what was really going on behind the fixed smiles and the public prayers remained mysterious. The army chief, General Alexeyev, who knew a good deal more than any politician ever would, complained to Guchkov about the poor conditions, ammunition shortages, and lack of food. No one could hide the fact that discipline was ragged at the best of times. A happy mood, meanwhile, was not always ideal. On the 1st or 14th of April, Sir William Robertson, the chief of the Imperial General Staff in London, cabled Knox and Hanbury Williams with a demand for information about Russia's combat readiness. "Give me your considered opinion," Sir William ordered. "You should divest your mind of claptrap, such as determination to win and fighting for freedom and so forth, remembering that without discipline and a reasonable administrative efficiency, an army is merely a leaderless mob." The information he was getting, at least from Knox, was inconclusive. The attaché had no time for the garrison in Petrograd, while the bureaucrats who ran the army had infuriated him. "The main idea seems to be to do as little work as possible," he had reported to London on the 18th or 31st of March 1917. "The general staff offices are closed after 5 p.m, and the artillery department shuts an hour earlier. The men are children. One of them said to me in the Duma, 'We have been slaves for 300 years. You will not grudge us a few weeks' amusement.' Naturally," he wrote home on the 2nd or 15th of April, "the troops at Petrograd have been expelled. 3/4 of their officers do nothing and have no sign of discipline. The government, it seems to me, have given up all attempts to protect the unfortunate army from political agitators." Knox felt a little better, though not much, when he drove out to tour the lines. He visited the Guards' depot near Petrograd towards the end of March, and April found him at the northern front. His findings were biased, because his main task was to push the British cause. But he spoke Russian, badly, and could listen to soldiers' complaints. As he delivered his lecture, he had one speech, remembered British academic Bernard Pears, "which I got to know by heart," and dished out maps and pictures of the Western Front. He often encountered a wariness about England, but he thought he could deal with that. A brisk talk, man to man, was all it took. More serious were the soldiers' stories about their officers, some of whom they had driven out or even killed. "What would happen in England?" one group of Russian conscripts had demanded. "If an officer came on parade and called his men a lot of pig-faced cattle?" It was not clear that anyone could stand a long campaign. The pro-war demonstrations in Petrograd might have been organised and paid for by the right-wing press, but frontline soldiers remained sceptical. "Those flag wavers," they said, "the people in clean uniforms with their demand for war to a final victory, should spend a few weeks in the trenches for themselves. That way, they would find out what fighting really meant, and we who have suffered for nearly 3 years could go home for a well-earned rest." There was still some hope for the front. Most soldiers had welcomed the Soviets' manifesto of the 14th or 27th of March, especially the paragraph about the loaded guns. The ammunition shortage rankled everywhere. And an intensive campaign by pro-war newspapers like Rech and Ruskaya Volya had reinforced the view that fighting should continue in the name of Russia and its military honour. Though officers felt nervous about controlling their troops, the fury of the earliest days had abated. No one could say for certain if the men would obey an order to attack. But at least they claimed to want to fight. Above all, the army's mood continued to be strongly anti-German. "There is no doubt that the extreme socialists with their Stop the War campaign have lost power," Knox wrote on the 2nd or 15th of April. The idea found little support among the troops, who have practical experience of the Hun. What really worried Knox, and everyone who relied on the army to fight on during the spring, was the rate of desertion. No power, and certainly no politician, could stop the steady flow of men returning home. In April, 1,000 soldiers were arriving every day at Kiev railway station. According to intelligence passed on to Knox, something like 1.5 million men had left their posts by the second week of April. The latest wave of German propaganda, again using leaflets dropped from aeroplanes, was already making things worse. People had started whispering that the Easter holiday was going to see a decree dividing up all Russian land, and many soldiers yearned to get back to their villages and make sure of their share. It was partly to combat the consequent panic that the Soviet published a statement in Izvestia on the 26th of March, or the 8th of April. The land it promised, the land that had been soaked by the sweat of the people, would certainly be given to the peasants in due course. Meanwhile, however, it will not be by means of violence, or fires, or murders, or arbitrary measures, that the free people will achieve its will, but by the authoritative voice which will be heard from behind the walls of the Constituent Assembly, elected by all the people. Stay where you are, in other words. And at some point, when Russia had a constitution and perhaps a head of state, the whole thing would turn out all right. The trouble was that the men at the sharp end of it were getting cynical. If I'm dead, one soldier quipped, I won't be needing the land anyway. The land question could only grow more acute with spring coming, when the fields would have to be sown. In an army drawn almost entirely from the countryside, the men might well dash home at any point. The provisional government, which had abolished the death penalty, had almost no means to prevent them. Meanwhile, in Petrograd, the Soviet was preparing to host a gathering for delegates from all over Russia. The first all-Russian conference of Soviets was scheduled for Easter weekend. Whatever compromises Tseretelli might have made, the people were about to have another chance to indulge their new taste for public meetings. The Bolsheviks had not played a large part in the events that month. Years later, official communist accounts of 1917 would paint the party as a united, relentless force for change. This was a lie, of course, but not the worst of that regime, for Bolshevism had a solid grassroots following that other socialist parties could only envy. It was the Bolshevik elite that still could not agree on anything. It must be confessed, a comrade from Petrograd was later to write, that before Lenin's arrival, there was rather a lot of confusion in the party. There was no definite, consistent line. The task of taking state power was depicted by a majority as a sort of distant ideal, and not, as a rule, presented as a close, urgent, and immediate aim. It was considered sufficient to support the provisional government. Vacillation and disunity were typical. In his retirement, Trotsky reached the same conclusion. As he put it, one could write an instructive chapter on the leadership of the Leninists without Lenin. The latter towered so high above his nearest disciples that in his presence they felt there was no need of solving theoretical and tactical problems independently. When they happened to be separated from Lenin at a critical moment, they amazed one another by their utter helplessness. There had been some notable triumphs. On the 4th or 17th of March, 2 days after the Tsar's abdication, an energetic group of activists had relaunched the Bolshevik newspaper Pravda. Although they had no printing press, they knew where to find one. In the small hours of a chill Saturday morning, a group of armed men burst through the door of a house on the bank of the Moika. Barging up the stairs, they made for the premises of Selsky Vestnik, a privately owned newspaper with spacious offices and a fine printing press. With encouragement from Selsky Vestnik's print workers, skilled men and for the most part socialists, the Bolsheviks cleared a space at the big table and pulled up some of the bentwood chairs. From that night on, they forced the sitting tenants to share everything from the huge rotary printing machine to the office kettle. It was much easier to seize a press, unfortunately, than to settle on an editorial line after an interruption of 3 years. Pravda's first number, which came out on Sunday, the 5th or the 18th of March, gave star billing to an appeal for membership fees. The paper did not tempt people to pay, however, for its editorial went no further than stating that the fundamental problem is to establish a democratic republic. Beyond that, its editors felt more comfortable printing the words of the Internationale and doggerel verse, beloved by Pravda's editors for decades to come, than trying to define the party's position on any urgent problem of the day. Observing the newspaper from outside, Sukarnov commented that there was no line at all, merely a vague, pogromist form. Pravda's lack of direction reflected divisions in the Bolshevik Party itself, whose Petrograd organization, local and national, seemed to be fighting long-running internal wars. The leftist Vibor Committee was still out of step with the national leaders. In particular, its members continued to believe that, pending the convocation of an assembly to agree on Russia's future constitution, any caretaker government would have to be formed of workers' Soviets, not dominated by the bourgeoisie. For some veteran Bolsheviks, who argued on principle that the Soviet should not oppose the provisional government unless it actually attacked the working class, this view, initially, was heresy. Even Shlapnikov believed that it was not possible for the Bolsheviks, or any working-class party, to take on the burden of government that Milyakov and Prince Lvov had been persuaded to assume. By late March, however, some of the party's second-tier leaders in Petrograd had begun to argue that Soviets, rather than any form of parliament, should be groomed to take power soon. The process would take time, however, and the people would need to be armed and prepared for the task, which would involve expanding the militia that the Bolsheviks knew as the Red Guards. It was at this point, on the 12th or 25th of March, that Kamenev and Stalin returned to the capital from Siberia. There was the usual welcome at the station, though Sukarnov had pointed out that they would not need a whole regiment for that. But there was a long history between the comrades in Petrograd and this duo. In Kamenev's case, the problem was that treason trial of 1915, at which he had betrayed the movement and showed shameful cowardice. In punishment, according to the current editors of Pravda, he should be banned from writing for the paper and from voting on its line. Party members were also wary of Stalin, citing unspecified personal characteristics as a reason for barring him on his return from full voting membership of the Central Committee. Before long, however, both men had elbowed their way into Pravda and forced the current editors aside. The impact was immediate and radical. Kamenev's first instinct, he confided in private, had been to shut the paper down. Now he was on the hunt for stylish writers with a range of views. Pravda has a completely unseemly, unsuitable tone, he told Sukarnov. So now I'm trying to attract contributors, or get hold of a few articles by writers with some reputation. Plurality of views and stylish writing had not been Bolshevik priorities before. But like many Siberians, including Tseretelli, Kamenev was sympathetic to the idea that socialists should work together. He argued that they had a short-term duty to support the bourgeoisie as well, though always with an eye to forcing democratic change. Crucially, Kamenev was also convinced that Russia would still have to fight and win its war, albeit mainly to defend the gains of revolution against Prussian tyranny. It was a theme that he explored in his first serious piece, which came out on the 15th or 28th of March with the title Without Secret Diplomacy. When one army collides with another, Kamenev wrote, the most absurd policy would be to propose that one of them lay down its arms and go home. That would not be a policy of peace, but of slavery. The free people will stand firmly at their posts, will reply bullet for bullet and shell for shell. The party's left-wing group was horrified. The day of the first issue of the transformed Pravda, Shlapnikov remembered, was a day of rejoicing for the defensists. In the executive committee itself, they met us with venomous smiles. There was an angry meeting in the office on the Moika. The kitchen was the only refuge left to Seltsky Vestnik's staff. Kamenev was censured, and Stalin silently abandoned him. But nonetheless, the newspaper's line had been pushed to the right. In the next week, Pravda published a series of conflicting pieces, appearing to have lost sight of its whole purpose. Wearied by the confused, tetchy debates, activists like Shlapnikov awaited the return of Lenin like the heavy artillery. As if on cue, a train with a distinguished passenger from Switzerland steamed into Petrograd. The date was the 31st of March, or the 13th of April, the day on which the Orthodox observed Good Friday. A larger crowd than usual had gathered, and the scarlet flags around the Finland station were more numerous than ever. In keeping with the custom now, there was a regimental band, and as the station clock ticked round to the appointed time, a welcoming committee assembled, this time including foreigners. The engine lights approached, the night air filled with steam, and in due course the guest of honour stepped down from the train. Dressed in a fur coat and black boots, he was a tall but crumpled figure, well past middle age, and while he was delighted by the reception, it also wearied him. The journey from Geneva, after all, had been a very arduous one. Turning to his fellow passengers, he hurried into the grand waiting room, and from there, after more speeches, he and his party made their way into the capital. The new arrival was Georgi Plekhanov. With Britain's blessing and support, the patriarch from Geneva had been permitted to return to Russia. The point was that Plekhanov, though a Marxist, was a sound man on the war, a patriot who could tell other socialists exactly where their duty lay. In gratitude for that, he had been escorted on the sea route to Bergen instead of suffering the trials of a sealed train, and for good measure, six more socialists had made the voyage with him. They were all foreigners this time, and they had been chosen in the hope that they might talk the language of the common working man. That was the theory, anyway. Moutet is a barrister, Paléolog noted in his diary. Cachin and Lafont are professors of philosophy. O'Grady is a cabinet maker, Thorne a plumber. French socialism is thus represented by intellectuals with a classical education, English socialism by manual workers. The Frenchman was exaggerating for effect. Will Thorne was not a plumber, but a former brickmaker who had been taught to read in a socialist discussion group by Karl Marx's youngest daughter, Eleanor. In 1917, as a trade union leader and MP for West Ham South, he joined James O'Grady, an MP from Leeds, although Paléolog was right about the cabinet-making, and William Sanders, the secretary of the Fabian Society, on a mission to talk some sense into the Soviet. The idea of sending them had originated in Paris, though Whitehall took it up at once. They were experienced public speakers, leaders in their world, but nothing had prepared these envoys, splendid types, Buchanan thought, for the reception that awaited them. The speeches at the station had been exhausting enough, especially after a train journey that felt more like a penal sentence than a trip from A to B. Now they discovered, somehow, grasping at stray words, that their arrival had coincided with a mass meeting, something important, and they were obliged to attend it. The meeting was the first all-Russian conference of Soviets, and the socialist elite of Petrograd had taken up position in a giant hall with workers, soldiers and peasants from all four corners of the empire. Plekhanov was bundled onto the stage like a bewildered pedigree bull. According to Sukhanov, he stood motionless in his fur coat and didn't say a word. The foreigners could only watch in silence, longing for their beds. The next day was not much better. Petrograd's allied diplomats led their tame socialists to the conference, but no one else engaged with them. However honourable and well-meaning they were as citizens, Sukhanov pointed out, they were really delegates from the allied governments and agents of Anglo-French imperialism. From the first, remembered Robert Bruce Lockhart, the result was a farce, with the British trio and the French completely lost in the wilderness of Russian revolutionary phraseology. Pouring water into his whisky that evening, Thorne told Buchanan that he had not met a deputy from the Soviet who looked as if he had done a day's work with his own hands. The ambassador concluded that the extreme socialists are not very amenable to foreign influence. The closing of the conference, Easter Sunday, for the Russian Orthodox, was the most rewarding. Again, the visitors were herded along to the meeting hall. But Plekhanov, who appeared on stage beside them, had now been fortified by a good night's sleep and a briefing. He opened with a rousing speech that delegates could all applaud, pointing to his distinguished foreign guests as if they were the very embodiment of international solidarity. When the foreigners actually spoke, however, it was the timbre of their voices that impressed the crowds, rather than anything they said. According to the sympathetic journalist Harold Williams, the audience responded to Cashin's dramatic inflections and gestures before it had the least idea what his words meant, while O'Grady raised his voice to Trafalgar Square dimensions, pouring out a stream of thunderous sound on soldiers and workmen. The rapture continued as Plekhanov took his last bow with the guests, presenting a real and thrilling symbol of Allied democracy. Even Sukarnov conceded that the atmosphere was festive and friendly. Perhaps it was as well, for festivity's sake, that no one had really discussed the war at all. In private sessions later on, when the talk finally turned to guns and treaty obligations, the visitor's luck ran out. Kasha found the Soviet so unwelcoming that he panicked, abandoned its prepared script, and telling everyone that France proposed to drop its claim to Alsace and Lorraine. It was a statement that no sane Frenchman could ever possibly have made, and the speech, like Cashin himself, was ridiculed. Neither Thorne nor O'Grady fared better. The wisdom of well-meaning Englishmen, let alone a brace of French theorists, was never likely to inspire a revived Russian war effort. "If the English would stop giving advice to Russia and the Russians," lamented a translator at the British Embassy, "and would understand that the revolutionaries are not a ragged mob of long-haired, more or less seedy ne'er-do-wells and flat-chested bespectacled students, but consist of all that is best in the country, then we should become more popular. It is a case of save us from our friends."